Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's global research center for the study and cultivation of trust. Welcome to a special series of the show where we will be recording on the ground from Davos at the 2023 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. Throughout the week, I will be speaking with attendees who are experts in their fields about this year's forum and gather their insights on our just released 2023 Edelman Trust Barometer. To kick off our series, I'm joined by the World Economic Forum's Adrian Monk. Adrian has been head of external engagement and communications for the World Economic Forum since 2009. Adrian is responsible for the forum's global media and communications presence, including its social media following of more than 30 million. Before joining the forum, Adrian was an international TV journalist, professor, and author of two books, including Can You Trust the Media? Adrian, welcome to Trustmakers.
Justin, thanks very much for having me on.
It's great to see you, and thank you for kicking off our Davos series. We're here in the Congress Center for the World Economic Forum's annual meeting. It makes me a little whimsical. It makes me think back to how we first met. Maybe we should start there.
Yeah, I mean, we met back in 2008, I think it was, and I was just helping out on the external staff of the of this event. And yeah, we were partners in crime trying to keep the show on the road back in the 2000s, or everyone calls the aughts these days.
And now you've been in this main job for more than a decade. How has that job evolved since you've been in that chair?
It's changed like the media landscape so much. I mean, I went from being an academic, being a professor running a journalism school. And I guess one of my biggest insights doing that job in the 2005-2010 era was that media, that organizations could become their own media. And I think that was what excited me about going to work with the forum. And then when I arrived, I realized just how hard that was going to be because, you know, you talk a lot about trust on the outside, but actually trust inside organizations to trust you enough to run something that looks like media or feels like media, that's pretty hard to kind of build.
And how did you build it? I mean, we often cite the World Economic Forum as an exemplar of becoming your own media company. It's something we talk to clients about all the time. Tell us a little bit how you built it, and also how did your journalistic experience inform that?
I remember when I first arrived, the forum had been involved with a magazine called WeLink, and there'd been a horrendous editorial error, which resulted in, I think, whole editions being pulped. And it was the kind of editorial mistake that every journalist kind of, you know, sweats over, loses sleep on. And Klaus said to me, you know, I learned a lesson from that. You know, I'm never going to get involved with anything in the media again. It's too much trouble.
Adrian, I remember actually a night where I think we almost were tearing pages out of it and considered doing it that way. It was quite a moment.
Yeah, and so that was a little before I arrived, but it definitely had burnt the forum on the idea of being its own media organization. So I hadn't quite realized how hard that burn had gone. But, you know, gently is the answer to building trust. So what we did was we started a small outlet for blogging. We republished other people's work that was on Creative Commons licenses that was good. And we basically shared a lot of stuff that we thought an organization like ours should be interested in around macroeconomics, around big global issues, written by other clever people. And building that slowly and gently, and the great thing about this place is I was given the kind of time and space to do it, was after about a year of doing that, we had strengthened our social media followings and we'd built a reputation for being a place where people could publish interesting things. So we started to get pitches. Once you start to get pitches, you start to be editorial, you have a bar, and so you get into this nice virtuous circle. Now, could you do that today with where social is? 100% you couldn't, because social is not anymore that kind of rocket ship to circulation and success. these days people would rely on newsletters, they'd look at other things.
Are you saying that you would not have been able to build it up in today's environment?
I don't think we wouldn't have used the same strategy. So back then, we were getting a presence on Twitter, we were getting a presence on Facebook, we were getting a presence on LinkedIn, and all of those platforms at various times have been, you know, dynamic or less dynamic. And I guess in the last 2 to 3 years, search has come back as the big driver of traffic to owned properties. So, you know, you're no longer at the place of saying, you know, with multi-million followings on Facebook, you can transfer, or Instagram, you can transfer that into clicks and views.
Where are you finding some of the most traction recently? And also, what are you seeing that's changing so you can give our listeners some observations?
I mean, the things I think, you know, that have changed over time are the growth of the visual social media. I mean, none of this to your audience is going to be any surprise. You know, the way that Instagram's evolved and TikTok have evolved as story platforms, the way that maybe Facebook has become less of a place where people share and click through to media, the way LinkedIn has evolved to, I think, becoming a really interesting, exciting professional platform and a well-managed one. The way that, you know, for example, newsletters have allowed us to create new audiences. You know, one of the things I did about 5 years ago was start an email newsletter. And I think it was might have been even further back than that, 6 or 7 years ago. And that now has 430,000 subscribers. And we built that with 600 people as our first audience. We actually built it the old-fashioned way, right? We enrolled all our staff as subscribers. We did ask them nicely. And they recommended it, shared it, and we built it organically to 430, which is kind of amazing, again, in the current era of building newsletters. But that was a moment in time, again, when there was a window open for people to be receptive to things like an email newsletter.
But it sounds like then part of why this has worked is you've always been kind of on the vanguard of whatever the kind of communications delivery trend is about to be. Is that fair?
We've tried to be. And that was, I think, part of my background being a professor was, you know, going into a journalism school and seeing what was being taught and then thinking about what skills were actually going to be needed in the future. And then thinking, too, about how important it is for us as professionals to stay really close to where the action is. Because once you are your own media organization, you're only as good as the latest trend in media. And the trends in media are, you know, only moving one way. They're moving richer, deeper. People want more content. They want better content. And if you're not willing to go and provide that, then, you know, someone else is going to step in and do it for you. So, you know, I don't think it's not because we're, you know, any smarter or wiser than anybody else, but we've just tried to stay on the bleeding edge of what's new and going on.
Yeah, and giving some further context from the Trust Barometer on this, we're launching the 2023 Trust Barometer this week here in Davos. As we've seen in prior years, business is the most trusted institution. Media is very much lagging. My employer is particularly well trusted. And when it comes to information, people trust information from their employer more than any other source. So I wonder, taking the discussion we're having here, I could see some of our corporate audiences being a little bit skeptical in this way, which is, well, you're the World Economic Forum. You look at all these other issues. We're a corporation. We're not looking across this range of social issues necessarily. How do these lessons apply to us, especially knowing that my employer media is the most trusted?
I mean, I think what you can see is, and it goes back to what I was saying about building our email newsletter, is that employees and staff are like the most valuable audience that you have. And they are a media audience. Unless you have a staff of, you know, half a dozen people and you can get them around your dinner table every day, you know, these people are going to reach you and read you through media. They're going to read your emails. They're going to read your social posts. They're going to read the stuff that you share. And that's how they're going to form an impression of you. So if that's how they're receiving what you're doing, shouldn't what you're doing reflect a kind of, you know, media level of sophistication, presentation, and thoughtfulness? And I think once you start applying those kind of rules to the way you communicate with people, yeah, I mean, okay, they might not want to know your views about everything. They might want to think it's irrelevant. But every company that's operating globally now is in different cultures. It's in different places with different issues. It's in different supply chains. All of these things, you know, cross into most of the global issues that we're talking about. And they need some nod, discussion, and employees and staff, they expect people to take them seriously.
Yeah, and I would say, look, both of us, I guess, right now our professions happens to be PR, but I would say one of the ways to make that information credible is to hire non-PR people to do that kind of media work. Like, and to me, that really gives it the credibility when it's someone who hasn't been trained in writing press releases and tweets, but someone who's really been trained as a journalist.
Yeah, I mean, look, the tools of building credibility are, you know, have been the tools journalism's tried to inculcate in people for generations. And, you know, those tools remain the same. You know, get the facts right, go and talk to people. And if you do that, you know, that's the kind of thing that will help your message go out to people and get the kind of reception that you want.
Great. So we're sitting here in a podcast studio, which is in the middle of the Congress Center, which is the epicenter of the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, often just shorthand as Davos. For our listeners, where this might be a little more new for them, can you just explain a little bit what is the annual meeting? What is Davos?
Sure. I mean, the annual meeting is something that was started back in 1971 by a young German business professor called Klaus Schwab, who is still running it today. And I mean, he basically persuaded a bunch of American business leaders mainly to come to Europe to tell Europeans the kind of secret of America's success. So the origin story of the forum is, you know, how can Europe keep up with you know, a country that has fantastic Cadillacs with big fins and, you know, this kind of Hollywood glamour and Europe kind of running around on Vespa scooters and trying to keep up. So that was the origin story of the forum. And it's grown from that, effectively, to become a membership organization where the members are people, they're companies. And Klaus's idea is kind of built off his experience as a young man. He grew up in the ruins of Germany that had been destroyed by the Second World War, you know, largely through its own doing. And to reconstruct it required an effort that brought together not just business, but government and every element of society, you know, rebuilding towns, literally churches from the ground up. And he was very intimately involved in the Franco-German kind of student movement, bringing together France and Germany, because the idea was that these two nations needed to be bound together in friendship in order for another war to be avoided. And out of that, I think, came his vision for the forum, which is that business needs to take all of the issues in society seriously. And it was a kind of vision that was very much embodied actually in German kind of conservatism in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And that vision kind of stays with us today. And I think it's still as relevant as it was when he started it.
And talk about what it's grown to today.
So today it's grown to this kind of behemoth, really. You know, I should explain that probably if you want to organize a massive conference, you know, Davos is quite an awkward place to organize it. It's not especially easy to get to, but although it has a fantastic Swiss train system that gets you in here, it really hasn't got enough beds to host all the people who come. Also, we don't control the town of Davos. You know, that Davos is run and owned and operated by the people who live here. And so we have this little space in the middle, which is the Congress Center. And around it is this kind of ecosystem village, if you like, a kind of off-Broadway of off Davos of events and things that's grown up around it. So we invite 3,000 people here every year, but like 30,000 people come to Davos itself. And there's a huge ecosystem beyond our meeting, which kind of takes part in parallel and makes this week in Switzerland one of the kind of busiest and most interesting in the Swiss year.
And looking very much at the official Davos that you're such an integral part of, what are you looking at for this week?
So we have, in addition to, you know, a huge number of kind of global CEOs, we have, you know, nearly 400 ministers from around the world coming, a huge number of trade ministers, finance ministers involved with climate and energy. And so we're looking to help facilitate some conversations that help them frame their year and move forward on some of the big things that they want to move forward on. So, you know, what Davos does is it operates as a kind of informal gathering place for senior figures in government and international organizations and other places to have some, if you like, unscripted conversations. And, you know, you've been around the international system long enough to know that if you're a CEO or a leader, you can barely move without someone having pre-written your talking points or pre-authored what you're going to say. And so sometimes you can feel like you're a kind of sock puppet for the organization rather than a leader. And this actually gives people a moment to kind of step back from all that and say, hold on a second, what am I going to be doing this year and what am I going to be trying to achieve?
Yeah, you know, I'm really curious about that last point. Do you feel in the decade plus that you've been here that the amount that CEOs are interacting with people in that unscripted, behind-the-scenes way has increased, decreased? Has the dynamic of that changed at all in terms of who they're interacting with?
I think there's a lot less formality than there was 10 years ago. And, you know, you've seen that in the whole style of some of the most outspoken CEOs in the world, where there's this very kind of, you know, relaxed, very informal kind of sofa style of management. But I still feel that for the rest of the world, you know, the rest of the world has different values to the ones we see in some of the most outspoken and high profile Western CEOs. And that actually, you know, it's as important as ever to kind of have some of the, you know, the conversations that can happen in a place like this that are maybe not sort of held on Twitter or WhatsApp or LinkedIn.
Yeah, well, there's an expectation, according to the Trust Barometer, for leaders to speak out. And that tends to be reported across most of the 28 countries that we look at. But to your point, it really is only a few countries where CEOs are speaking out on societal issues. Do you see that evolving?
Look, I think, you know, in the present cost of living crisis that we're seeing around the world and in the present environment, I think CEOs are being expected to, you know, to look after their businesses rather than necessarily, you know, comment on every social issue that comes along. But at the same time, you know, you're talking about winning over and motivating human beings, and what wins them over and motivates them is a whole range of different things. And one of that is an emotional and a personal attachment to the values and cultures of companies. And so there is a double expectation on people, I think, to be at least, you know, walking the talk on some of the stuff that, that their companies engage with.
The theme of Davos this year is around polarization, and in fact, the theme of the Edelman Report is navigating a polarized world. In this increasingly polarized environment, what does that mean for the role of business and the role of CEOs? Do you see business and CEOs having a role in restoring the social fabric? Is that a reason for them to, as you were just talking about, to kind of retrench a little bit when it comes to speaking out? What's your sense?
Look, I think business is finding itself in the firing line from a number of different sides. I think it's getting attacked from the populist far right for maybe being too woke on certain issues and, you know, pushing too hard on climate responses and other kinds of issues. I think from the other side of the political spectrum, it's being, you know, critiqued for not, you know, doing what it says it's going to do, for greenwashing, greenhushing, those kinds of things. So, you know, you can maybe, I don't know if people would say they'd ever sympathize with CEOs because, you know, that's not the world in which we live. But if you are a CEO, you might feel that you're being shot from both sides. And, you know, what do you do to walk down the middle of the street? Do you keep quiet? Do you say nothing? I think the approach that works best is the one that's most authentic to the leader in question. You know, for leaders who wear their hearts on their sleeve, then there's no reason in this environment to stop doing that. But for people who are a little bit quieter, then, you know, they might not want to put their heads above the parapet in the present environment. But when it comes to the core of your question about rebuilding that trust, I think it's about helping navigate those businesses through tough times. And I think what we're seeing in Silicon Valley right now is a hard wind blowing. And I think how Silicon Valley navigates some of that stuff is a real test for its values. And maybe it's a test that it might not be passing right now because, you know, it's been on the kind of the crest of the wave of success now for such a long time that when things get tough, you know, manufacturing industry knows this, other industries know this, you have to look after people as well when times get tough. You can't just abandon ship and throw people overboard when things get difficult. And I think newer industries are going to have to learn that maybe the hard way, that you've got to treat people with the respect and dignity that they deserve.
Yeah, well, what's very interesting in our findings is despite those headwinds that you just talked about, we look at trust around competence and ethics. Business this year is the only institution seen as both competent and ethical. And very notably, ethics in business has gone up 20 points in the last 3 years. So now business is almost seen as ethical as NGOs, which is an incredibly surprising finding. Is that good news for business? Bad news for business? Mixed? How should business be reacting to that finding?
Look, I think, you know, people working for companies want to hold them to higher standards. You know, they don't just want to hold politicians to high standards. They want to hold their leadership to high standards and the companies they work for. And I think also we're in a situation now where there is a war for talent, where there is a need to bring, for example, older workers back into the workforce. And those workers very often might not necessarily need to re-enter the workplace. You know, when it comes to going back into doing something, they want to do something that makes a difference in a positive way, that feels like it speaks to their values as well as their paychecks. And I think in that case, companies really do need to take those issues seriously.
How much of the rise in business ethics might be attributed to the type of stakeholder capitalism that's espoused here with the World Economic Forum, this idea that business can make profits and do good?
I think a lot of that is a zeitgeist thing. I'd love to say that we, you know, we could take any credit for those kind of moves. I think that they've been a long time coming or re-coming. You know, if you think about the place they first emerged during the Cold War, when, you know, we were fighting a global enemy in communism, and basically to win that battle, companies had to look after people. They had to look after their staff. They had to look after workers, and countries had to do the same. And I think now we're re-emerging into the 21st century, where after a long hiatus, we are once again seeing a world in which there's a kind of ideological struggle taking place. And if you want to win that struggle, you have to bring people on side. And if you bring people on side, that means acting ethically. It means looking after them. It means actually treating them with dignity and respect.
Yeah, I also think it means collaborating with the other institutions, and the lagging of media and government doesn't help business at all. Let's focus for a moment on media, especially you wrote the book, Can You Trust Media? But also in your role, you're almost a conduit between certainly your organization, but also business and media. What's your sense of the state of collaboration between business and media right now?
I mean, right now, I guess collaboration is a tough word, because, you know, the great kind of Mencken quote is, you know, the relationship between, you know, journalists and people in power should be like that between a dog and a lamppost. You know, journalists really should be holding people accountable, maybe not so much collaborating with them. But what I do think is important is that we get the right stories out, that the cheap kind of contrarian stuff that passes for a lot of commentary is really just hoodwinking people and not doing anyone any service. You know, the journalism I admire is the kind of deep investigations that we've seen with things like Panama Papers, that we've seen like Paradise Papers, where really smart journalists have collaborated together to produce stuff that's made people behave in a more ethical way. It's made people pay attention and take notice. So I think, you know, should they be collaborating? The old days, the collaboration was in the form of advertising. You know, businesses advertised on media. Now we see it in sponsorship. I think, you know, people want some distance between their media and business because they do want that accountability. But what you have seen in the last, I think, 20 years is a hollowing out of the financial strength of media. And with that has come a loss of audience and a loss of trust. And people have other places to look for people they find credible. their colleagues, their peers, their family, their friends. And, you know, through social media, they've had a way of accessing that. Now, I think we're at a little bit of an inflection point, and I think maybe the dynamic is shifting because people are starting to say, well, hang on, social media is not necessarily showing me what I want to see. It's not necessarily providing that link. But I think, you know, media in the old school sense of media is not coming back. You know, we're not going to move back to a Walter Cronkite world where a couple of trusted, wizened, elderly figures tell us what to think about the world.
Well, and in fact, the way we might be moving is a much scarier version. And you talked about social media and non-traditional media. There's certainly been a rise in disinformation. Disinformation is something that you wrote about more than a decade ago in your academic work, and the World Economic Forum has been a target of disinformation. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a fascinating new book out by Tom Ridd, who's a professor at Johns Hopkins, about what he calls active measures, which is how the KGB used to describe its own disinformation campaigns. And it, you know, he points to their expertise. And I think the fact that disinformation was a kind of state-sponsored tool during the Cold War has given a kind of legacy in today's social media age where we've seen it being used in ways to, if you like, create dissent, create difficulty, create problems. You know, for example, in the 60s, you know, the KGB sponsored research into violence against African Americans. I mean, real violence against African Americans, and shared it across Africa as a way of destroying America's influence and base in that continent. Now, that was real information, but packaged up in a way and used in a way to achieve a political goal. I think what we're seeing now is a lot more anonymous actors, a lot of state-sponsored sandboxing of disinformation, and also a lack of understanding about the actual impacts. So, for example, we know that in certain countries, there was a lot of work to provide, say, anti-vaccine narratives. You know, now, those kind of narratives also rebounded on the countries involved in producing them, because their own populations became very skeptical about vaccines. And so they then underwent a rather painful process of having to give one message darkly through the dark web and another message to their own citizens. So, you know, the current state of disinformation is that it's too easy for countries to get involved in that space, but it's also too difficult for them to control what happens once they unleash it. It's a very, very dumb weapon, but which requires a lot of work and imagination to weaponize.
Yeah, and more corporations are becoming the target of disinformation. Any advice for what's the antidote to disinformation?
I mean, I love to say I've got the silver bullet for tackling disinformation, but I think, you know, one has to accept that it's part and parcel of the current ecosystem. You know, social media companies are aware of it, but they're not tackling it in the way that, for example, a traditional publisher would tackle it. You know, we're seeing it kind of spill into the political sphere and into the mainstream. I think ultimately you've just got to keep on doing what you're doing and also responding to it with the facts, because there is also, you know, a huge reservoir of, you know, humanity that is basically wants factual, rational discourse that, you know, doesn't think that NASA faked the moon landings, doesn't think the world is flat, doesn't think there's a kind of weird cabal of people somehow running the world from somewhere in, you know, be it Switzerland or elsewhere. And those people deserve decent, high-quality information.
Disinformation seems a kind of depressing place to end this podcast. Let me try to wrap us up on a high note. Looking forward to the week, what's one thing that you're excited about?
I mean, there's 3,000 people here who all have incredible stories to tell. I mean, for me personally, one of the things I'm most excited about is I've been involved in helping start a hub for young people in a refugee camp in Kenya in a place called Kakuma. And we've been able to bring one of the young refugees from that camp here to Davos to talk with some of the business leaders and some of the other folks about the incredible people that he lives with. and what they can do. And one of the fantastic things about, you know, about the remote working experience that we've had is that we've developed some tools that now can help people who are in places like that to be integrated into the economy. So now, you know, the revolution in work that we've seen in the last couple of years, I mean, a horrible revolution prompted by the worst thing on earth that we wouldn't want to repeat, but it's given this boost to working remotely globally that I think is going to change a hell of a lot of things and make much better the lives of people in hard to get to places who can get some connectivity. So for me personally, that's something I'm very excited about.
That's a great way to end this conversation, Adrian. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justin.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.